This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace. Personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book The Myth of Human Supremacy to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hello, everybody. It's Benjamin the Donkey.
Hello yourself, Benji. Have you come to help me celebrate Guy McPherson's birthday?
Hee-haw! Hee-haw!
Well, hold your horses. I mean your donkeys. First, I want to talk about our title, and then I want to give a thorough climate change update, the kind of reporting that people used to expect of me when I had a regular segment on Extinction Radio when Gene Gibson was producing, along with some of the more scientific stuff Guy used to report when Nature Bats Last was a weekly show. Then I'll bring out Dr. McPherson and give you a chance to share your limericks in his honor, okay?
Hee-haw!
Okay, so, why Lysistrata? It's the title of a play by Aristophanes written in the 5th century BC, in which women seize control of the national treasury in order to stop the funding of perpetual wars. To accomplish their aim, the women withhold sexual gratification from the men until the men agree to end the fighting. The men experience increasingly enormous and, highly visible pain as the play progresses. Aristophanes included the war between the sexes as a comedic element in order to more memorably deliver his political message of peace and reconciliation. In those days before the printing press and mass communication, theater was the media. In recent times, the idea of a sex strike as a protest tactic and bargaining chip was adapted to the domestic issue of gun violence by Spike Lee in a movie set in Chicago, complete with rap lyrics, and by Matt Cooper in a comedy set in Texas. Energized by the Women's March of 21 January, which had overwhelming support across genders, inspired by the Day Without an Immigrant of 16 February, which had overwhelming support across ethnicities, with some restaurant owners even closing for the day in solidarity, and motivated by the impending International Women's Day on 9 March, the idea of a day without a woman has some initial momentum in the flesh and blood world. The call to action is dated 3 February and appeared in the far-left Viewpoint magazine. It was reprinted in the UK Guardian on 6 February. The list of author organizers reads like a who's who of radical feminism. Angela Davis, Distinguished Professor Emerita, University of California, Santa Cruz, member of the jury for the 2012 Russell Tribunal on Palestine, and if my memory serves me correctly, co-founder of the Black Panthers. Barbara Ransby, activist, writer, historian, professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, author of Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement, editor-in-chief of Souls, and president of the National Women's Studies Association. Cinzia Aruza, assistant professor of philosophy at the New School for Social Research in New York, feminist socialist activist, author of Dangerous Liaisons, The Marriages and Divorces of Marxism and Feminism. Kianga Yamata Taylor, assistant professor in Princeton University's Center for African American Studies, author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Linda Martin Alcoff, professor of philosophy at Hunter College and the City University of New York Graduate Center, author of Visible Identities, Race, Gender, and the Self. Nancy Fraser, professor of philosophy and politics at the New School for Social Research, author of Redistribution or Recognition and Fortunes of Feminism. Razmia Youssef Oda, associate director of the Arab American Action Network and leader of that group's Arab Women's Committee. Titi Bhattacharya, teacher of history at Purdue University, author of The Sentinels of Culture, Class, Education, and the Colonial Intellectual in Bengal, with publications in the Journal of Asian Studies, South Asia Research, and the New Left Review. This stellar group of women put out a call to, quote, join with feminist groups from around 30 countries for an international day of striking, marching, blocking roads, bridges, and squares, abstaining from domestic, care, and sex work, boycotting, calling out misogynistic politicians and companies, striking in educational institutions, close quote. Citing recent women's strikes not connected with the recent U.S. presidential election in Italy, Poland, Ireland, South Korea, and Latin America as their inspiration, as well as the women's marches on 21 January, they call upon us to rise above so-called lean-in feminism and other forms of corporate feminism and oppose the patriarchy itself. But you'll be hard-pressed to find coverage of this strike in the American media. And do you know what's got the mainstream the most scared about the idea of a women's strike? I'll give you a hint. It's not about sex. But you knew that, right? Lysistrata denied sexual gratification to the men until the women's demands were met for an end to the perpetual war between Athens and Sparta. But I don't think our modern men would suffer much from lack of sex for a day. Okay, here's another hint. The Women's March was on a Saturday, while International Women's Day, like the Day Without an Immigrant, falls on a weekday and would thus have an economic impact. Oh no! The corporatocracy would be badly crippled if women refused to go to work, even for a single day. Imagine if we took the strike seriously and stayed home until our demands are met. Demands like repeal of all laws regarding health care decisions, funding for health care that actually provides health care instead of mandated sick insurance, and full funding for Planned Parenthood, daycare, and education. When did we lose our willingness to take a risk, make a sacrifice in order to have an impact? I sort of knew it would come to this when I observed local defund DAPL demonstrations taking place on the weekend in front of closed banks on deserted streets in the central business district. On the flip side, my local Mardi Gras celebration is on Sunday for the convenience of the wage slaves and so as not to disrupt commerce. What part of Fat Tuesday do they not understand? And isn't the objective of a general strike supposed to be the nonviolent disruption of commerce? Oh, right, we have a newly defined crime called economic terrorism. Okay, so have me arrested. Or refuse to contribute just one day's tax dollars to finance the oppression of the real terrorists. It doesn't matter what your favorite cause is or what specific grievance you have against the current administration. All of it is financed with your tax dollars. So take a day off without pay and connect with your met need for integrity as you contemplate the contribution you are withholding. Contemplate the words of Mario Savio from more than half a century ago. Quote, "There comes a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all."
You know, famous rich person Leona Helmsley famously said, "We don't pay taxes, only the little people pay taxes." Observe social hierarchy. It'll explain why some crimes get acquittal. Till overshoot, we're still doomed with it here. Laws are for people who are little. Hee-haw!
Leona Helmsley is absolutely correct. So when are we going to stop acting like little people, like little sheeple, like wage slaves, and step into our true power as the 99.99%? Nobody said it would be painless to turn our backs on the crumbs from the master's table that we mistake for earned privilege in our pursuit of safety, convenience, and low prices. We're like addicts chasing the memory of that very first high. So stop, and do it with lots of self-love and self-compassion, just for one day, just to convince yourself that it's your lifestyle, not your living, that you have been brainwashed into thinking you need to earn. Your life is a gift from the earth, and the earth provides all that you need to sustain it: food, water, air, and other beings with whom to enjoy what poet Mary Oliver called your one wild and precious life. It bears repeating that women have been the moving force behind the No Dapple movement, and women have been the traditional peacemakers, peacekeepers, and peacebuilders around the world and throughout time. So a women's strike makes sense at this time, just as it makes sense that the No Dapple movement, framed as protection of the gifts freely given to living beings by the earth, would be led by the indigenous people who hold earth connection central in their cosmology. There were a trickle of mentions of the planned strike for International Women's Day in connection with the Day Without an Immigrant, but nothing in the corporate media, and even the trickle dried up when the patriarchy convinced the privileged that they'd be taking some economic risk. So now the American media is attempting to dilute the idea into an after-work feel-good meditation and talking circle. The only more recent American coverage I found that still frames the event as a wildcat strike is an article dated 21 February by Megan Grant in Bustle, a New York-based publication. But since the whole world is watching, I went to Al Jazeera, my favorite global source, and there I found a far more promising prognosis in an article by Lena Afridi, also dated 21 February, titled, "A True General Strike is Possible in Chumps America," with the tagline, "This is the moment to take action for establishing meaningful connections among communities and issues." What a breath of fresh air. Afridi ties the idea of a strike back to a 2 February strike in New York by the Yemeni community in response to the executive order banning Muslims from traveling in the U.S. But that strike was unique in that it also spotlighted protest against the planned Mexican border wall. Yes, you heard correctly. An action coalition coalesced on behalf of mostly Muslim Yemenis and mostly Catholic Mexicans. Need I mention that this was also a women-led action? What could be achieved, asks Lena Afridi, If all Americans stopped work at offices, factories, and restaurants, skipped class, and ceased household tasks. She calls for a feminist and women's movement with issues of racial and economic justice in the forefront, and including union and non-union workers across demographics. She names the paradox that those who fear the tactic the most are those who have at once the most to gain and the most to lose. She finds the U.S. lagging relative to the rest of the world in the courage to implement the tactic of a general strike, but she does cite a few recent success stories, most notably the strike of 2006 against H.R. 4437, the immigration policy proposal that would have funneled funds to increased security at the U.S.-Mexico border and made living in the U.S. without documentation a felony. Sound familiar? In closing, I offer the last few short paragraphs from Afridi's article. Quote, "The rise of the Trump administration is a boiling point for immigrants, women, Muslims, indigenous people, queer and trans people, poor and working people, and all people of color in this country. Trump's policies on policing, immigration, women's rights, and foreign policy are frightening, but in each case, they are just an extension of past concessions and repressive policies. These are not new issues, and they are not new problems. Injustices against marginalized people are very much ingrained in American history. However, this is a political moment where meaningful connections among communities and issues are not only necessary, but actually possible. In order for a national general strike to be truly meaningful and effective, it must speak to all those that have routinely been silenced. The 8 March Day Without a Woman strike has the potential to be such an action, or act as a stepping stone to a day where a true American general strike is possible." End quote. The thing that excites me the most about the prospect of disrupting business as usual is that it will surely contribute to the collapse of the post-industrial globalized economy. I am absolutely convinced that the machine needs its wage slaves more than the wage slaves need money, and that the sooner the machine comes to its grinding halt, the better chance we'll have of moving through our addictions. However, as is so typical in socialist or populist movements, I think the framing around racial and economic justice is rather short-sighted or superficial in the face of climate chaos and habitat loss. The aspects that concern me the most deeply are the following. 1. Loss of glaciers and ice caps, which can't help but accelerate global warming through moistening of the upper troposphere from evaporation, and with consequent sea level rise through runoff from melting. 2. The death of the world ocean due to acidification from the carbon dioxide load and resulting damage to the coral reefs, the largest, most ancient, and most elderly living beings on Earth, that provide wonderful examples of symbiosis and cross-species collaboration in addition to habitat for literally millions of species. 3. Loss of topsoil, whether through runoff from the increasingly severe drought-flood cycle or through depletion of soil organisms from the use of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides, or the practice of deep-till monoculture. Of course, depleted soil means a qualitatively and quantitatively depleted food supply, even before we factor in the direct disastrous effect of higher temperatures on our capacity to grow and store grain at a scale that can feed our ever-increasing global population, arguably the root cause of all of our problems. And 4. Generation of waste, whether organic, inorganic, or radioactive. The island of plastic waste in the Pacific has now reached 3 times the size of the state of Texas. and microbeads from cosmetics and medicines are killing marine life from the plankton at the base of the food web all the way to the large fish we and other large mammals depend upon for food. In his interview with Guy McPherson last month, Gary Null reported that we've had 7 once-in-500-year events and more than 12,000 so-called unique environmental events in 2016 in the U.S. alone. No wonder I haven't been able to keep up. So I hope you'll forgive me if I fail to include the event that struck closest to home for you in my report. Marking another milestone for a changing planet, scientists reported in the New York Times on 18 January that the Earth reached its highest temperature on record in 2016, trouncing a record set only a year earlier, which beat one set in 2014. It is the first time in the modern era of global warming data that temperatures have blown past the previous record 3 years in a row. According to Deke Arndt, chief of global climate monitoring for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, quote, a single warm year is something of a curiosity. It's really the trend and the fact that we're punching at the ceiling every year now that is the real indicator that we're undergoing big changes, end quote. Since 1880, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's records show only one other instance where global temperature records were set 3 years in a row, in 1939, 1940, and 1941. The Earth has warmed so much in recent decades, however, that 1941 now ranks as only the 37th warmest year on record. National Aeronautics and Space Administration's calculations suggest that the planet has warmed by well over a half degree Fahrenheit from 2013 to 2016. That is a huge change for the surface of an entire planet to undergo in just 3 years, and it appears to be the largest temperature increase over a 3-year period in the National Aeronautics and Space Administration record, which begins in 1880. Of the 17 hottest years on record, 16 have now occurred since 2000. Scientists have calculated that the heat accumulating throughout the Earth because of human emissions is roughly equal to the energy that would be released by 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs exploding across the planet every day. The Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany finds that melting in the Antarctic has reached unstoppable tipping points. Climate News Network speaks of tipping points as a result of not curbing emissions. The World Meteorological Organization describes 2016 as an alarming year and also speaks of tipping points. The Institute of Governance and Sustainable Development points to tipping points for abrupt climate change. Do I detect a pattern here? The World Glacier Monitoring Service of the University of Zurich says glaciers are melting 300% faster than they were in the 20th century. Loss of glaciers reduces the albedo, or reflectivity, of the Earth such that more solar radiation is converted to heat. The Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization of Australia says glacial thawing could raise sea levels by 11 feet. Chinese government's official environmental agency says glacial retreat in the Himalayas spells trouble for the fresh water supply throughout the Asian continent. Desertification has claimed 26,000 communities in China alone. 50% of their rivers are dry, and the remaining water is so polluted it's not even fit for irrigation by Western standards. Robert Scribler wrote back-to-back blogs late last month and early this month about ice. He reports widespread episodes of surface melt. During the 2016 to 2017 Southern Hemisphere summer, Antarctic surface temperatures are ranging between 0.5 and 1 degree Celsius above 1979 to 2000, with periods of local temperatures up to 20 C above average and above the freezing mark on numerous occasions in the coastal zones. a 1 in 3.5 million event has moved to about 1 in 300, and a 1 in 300 event has moved to about 1 in 7. The American Geophysical Union says the West Antarctic ice shelf is cracking up from the inside out. The University of California at Santa Cruz says the West Antarctic ice shelf is heating from the bottom up. Melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet alone could raise sea levels by 16 feet. Meanwhile, at Larsen C, an iceberg as big as Rhode Island could break away within weeks or months along a 110-mile-long, 1,500-foot-wide rift, according to the British Antarctic Survey. Robert Scribler puts that potential iceberg at the size of Connecticut and says it's now only hanging by a 15 to 20-mile thread. Large surface melt ponds along the far east Antarctic, the Amory Ice Shelf, are up to 3 miles wide and 20 miles long, yet most of almost 50 billion tons of melt come from underneath due to warming of the ocean. At the western edge of the East Antarctic, the British Halley 6 research team had to evacuate their base of operations on the Brunt Ice Shelf due to the doubling in length in less than 3 months of a rift which had been growing only gradually until late 2016. The Arctic is in crisis, according to Brian Kahn, writing for Climate Central on 6 February. Kahn reports that sea ice hit a record low maximum last winter for the second year in a row, and the second lowest minimum ever recorded last fall. A fairly rapid refreeze in late September is being reversed as wave after wave of warm, moist air comes north from the tropics. December saw temperatures at or above freezing. January temperatures were up to 35 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, and a February storm registered barometric pressures in the range associated with a Category 4 hurricane. According to Robert Scribler's blog, Arctic sea ice volume for January averaged around 14,000 cubic kilometers, about the same as the average for early July in 1979 through 2016, a time span already characterized by drastic decline. In satellite images of the Arctic, the current winter sea ice extent looks like the summer sea ice extent for 1939. Melting of the Arctic ice cap could raise sea levels by 20 feet, and this influx of fresh water can further collapse the Gulf Stream so that warm water from the tropics can more easily penetrate the Arctic. Robert Scribler attracts some interesting and knowledgeable commenters to his blog. One is Colorado Bob, who offers a vivid description from Climate Central of the effects of these collapsing ice shelves. They, quote, work like backstops, slowing the flow of the glaciers that feed them. When an ice shelf collapses, those glaciers speed up, meaning they send more ice from land to ocean, raising sea levels. In the case of Larsen B, the glaciers that fed it flowed 6 times faster after its demise, end quote. Other researchers are saying 8 times faster. Meanwhile, on the other side of a narrow strait called the Drake Passage, 1 million hectares are burning in Argentina. More on that momentarily. And across from Antarctica on the other side, Colorado Bob reports a record-breaking heat wave in Australia, 34 consecutive days above 35 C, that's 95 Fahrenheit, doubling the previous record of 17 days above 35 C. Another interesting commenter from Robert Scribler's blog is Andy in South Dakota, who offered a clear description of the physical mechanics of the freeze-thaw cycle. Quote, water, being the fascinating material that it is, contracts as you cool it, until it hits 4 degrees Celsius. Then, as you cool it further, it expands. To complicate matters, fresh water, for example snow melt, freezes at 0 C, while seawater doesn't freeze until minus 1.5 C to minus 1.8 C, end quote.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequiturs archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Gary Null reports that there are more than 400 dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico due to agricultural runoff. He filmed one near the mouth of the Mississippi River that was larger than the state of New Jersey. The American Geophysical Union says a surge in methane emissions will threaten efforts to slow climate change. Harvard University anticipates a surge in methane from the thawing tundra as well as from the warming ocean. However, even the most cursory review of global media seems to indicate that the clathrate gun has already fired, despite a recent downturn in the estimates of the quantity of sequestered methane. University of Chicago says Dust Bowl conditions now are worse than in the 1930s and will obliterate modern crops. The Daily Mail reports that an almost biblical, quote-unquote, 3,000-foot-high, 30-mile-wide dust and sand storm in Phoenix, Arizona was the largest ever recorded in the U.S. Princeton University Engineering School attributes the unprecedented severity of the storm to climate change. The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign attributes extreme winter storms to global warming. The University of Georgia predicts floods of climate refugees in the U.S. Africa has about 150 million climate refugees now due to the failure of croplands, due to lack of stability in the ages-old monsoon cycle. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reports unprecedented Pacific Ocean die-offs. El Niño is becoming a permanent climate fixture that will create more severe storms in the Pacific. The European Center for Geoscience Research says climate change could transform the Mediterranean into a desert. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration Jet Propulsion Laboratory reports California is reverting to desert. More than 100 million trees have died due to unprecedented drought and new pests and pathogens in California alone. Thousands of acres have been lost due to huge wildfires from the desert southwest to the boreal forests of the Canadian plains. Robert Scribler's collaborator, Colorado Bob, quotes a California firefighter who said more than a decade ago, quote, "We used to have a fire season. We burn year-round now," close quote. Nearly a million acres burned in Chile at the end of last month, with severe impact anticipated on the wine industry. 11 people were killed, almost 3,000 lost their homes, and more than 5,000 were evacuated, mostly from the town of Santa Olga, which was completely destroyed. Some 47 people have been detained on suspicion of arson. Gary Null reports that the Amazon rainforest is losing 50 to 100 acres per minute, and the Amazon River itself is shrinking such that villages that used to be on the riverbank are now set back 100 yards. All of that being said, I think we're ready to introduce Guy McPherson. Benji?
You know, the first time I saw Guy in California, just before the meeting started, Peter Melton suggested privately that Guy should start off slow about what's coming with that particular crowd. But when he invited me to open with a limerick, it wasn't the upbeat, gentle start they were looking for. Guy comes to California. We give a big hello to Guy, but also start saying goodbye. We ain't gonna lie, the end is now nigh, and soon we're all going to die. Hee-haw!
Well, that's pretty cold. In case some of our listeners are not familiar with Guy's work, I'll give the thumbnail bio. Dr. Guy McPherson is Professor Emeritus of Conservation Biology at the University of Arizona, with specialization in climate change and its consequences for habitat. However, as has been mentioned in previous shows, he was subjected to NSA surveillance and was accused of being an anarchist, to which he pleads guilty as charged, and an eco-terrorist, on which he withholds judgment pending further definition of terms. He walked away from his tenured position after his message was deemed too radical to be allowed by authorities too lacking in insight to recognize that a radical is one who gets to the root, or in the more spiritual activist framing I prefer, one who is in service to truth. His book, Going Dark, is next on my reading list, after I finish The Gandhian Iceberg by Chris Moore Backman that was recommended to me by Cheryl Angel of the Lakota Tribe in her recent presentation at Stanford University on behalf of the Standing Rock Water Protectors. So, Benji, how about a warm welcome for Guy?
You know, when I found out that Guy is a determinist just like me, I wrote Collections of Molecules. In or out of ivory towers, we've no self-determining powers, but we're glad Faith's direction brought Guy's collection around here to influence ours.
Thanks, Benji. That's more like it. Did you know it's Guy's birthday next week?
Hee-haw!
No, I promise I won't sing. But yeah, I heard him say on a recent interview that he's one of those lucky ones who was born on February 29th, so he only has a true birthday every 4 years and is therefore just a young teenager. So that's why I wanted him to have a virtual presence on today's show. But first, let's celebrate with the Beatles' birthday song from the White Album. Happy birthday, Guy McPherson. We are so glad you were born. So let's go over an abbreviated version of your visit with Gary Null last month. There were really only 4 questions I could tease out. Number 1, did you recently state that from your perspective, civilization would begin to disintegrate within the next 10 years?
I think it's far worse than that. I can't imagine there will be a human being on the planet 10 years from today. I think civilization is on its way out much sooner. It appears that we are headed for an ice-free Arctic. The Arctic Ocean has not been ice-free during the span of humans on the planet. This is truly unprecedented, and it could happen this summer. An analysis completed by the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College indicated that the Arctic would be ice-free, that was their prediction, in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. I think we've dodged a bullet at least four times, and it would surprise me if we didn't have an ice-free Arctic this summer or next summer, 2017 or 2018. When that happens, I don't see any way to avoid the prediction by Natalia Shkova and colleagues at the European Geophysical Union meetings in 2008. That prediction involves a 50 gigaton burst of methane arising out of the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean, triggering a 1.3 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise. Tack that onto the approximately 1.6 degrees above baseline that the planet finds itself at right now, and that takes us well beyond the temperature globally that has supported humans in the past. It's difficult for me to imagine civilization persists at approximately 3 degrees Celsius above baseline with a little over a third of that temperature rise coming in the span of a few weeks or a few months, as predicted by Natalia Shkova, Igor Semelatov, and colleagues at that European Geophysical Union meeting. That's just civilization. There's more. Once civilization collapses, goes away, declines, reaches its overdue end, whatever you call it, this civilization, like all others, depends upon the ability to grow and store grains. Once we get to about 3 degrees Celsius above baseline, higher than the temperature that has supported humans on this planet in the past, it's hard for me to imagine, and I think almost any mainstream climate science would support the notion that anything above 2 degrees Celsius above baseline takes us beyond the ability to grow grains at scale. That happens, we experience a lack of global dimming, and that is going to be responsible for about 3 degrees Celsius additional global average temperature rise in a very short period of time. Global dimming results from burning fossil fuels that put particulates into the atmosphere, most notably sulfates associated with burning, quote, low-quality coal. Those sulfates serve as an umbrella over the planet. They go up into the atmosphere, and they reflect incoming sunlight and keep Earth cooler than it would be otherwise if we hadn't burned that low-quality coal and put the sulfates up into the atmosphere. So we're in quite the paradox here. Civilization itself is a heat engine. We burn those fossil fuels. It produces the greenhouse effect. It holds the heat close to the planet. And at the same time, burning fossil fuels puts aerosols into the atmosphere that protects us. And the global average temperature rise associated with the falling out of the sky of those sulfates will be truly catastrophic for our species. That could happen in as little as 18 months. We could have an ice-free Arctic by 2019, the far end of the range predicted by the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College. And so it's difficult for me to imagine we would have habitat for our favorite species 5 years out from now.
Thank you for that clarity. I apologize to our listeners for the audio quality, but it does get better in the remaining segments. Number two, Guy, would you please explain for us the most devastating consequences of these feedback loops that will begin to cause food not to be able to be grown and drinkable water not to be available? In particular, what will happen to our great cities that rely on food and water shipped in from elsewhere?
We are already seeing a situation that is as bad and is certainly going to get worse than the Great Dust Bowl of the United States during the 1930s. Timothy Egan wrote a book about that event called The Worst Hard Time. It came out about 10 years ago. He wanted to capture the opinions and experiences of the people still alive who survived the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. Well, I refer to that book as the second worst hard time. The worst hard time is still in front of us, and it looks like it's being manifest faster than expected. We are already seeing Dust Bowl-type conditions all over the interior of large continents in the Northern Hemisphere. That's because the interior of large continents heats up at least twice as fast as the global average. So we're at about a degree and a half Celsius above baseline for the global average. What that means is we're at at or higher than 3 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline for the interior of large continents, that's where we grow the grains. Once we get that kind of high temperature, which produces instability in the climate system, then we have floods occurring in Texas, the likes of which Texas has never seen. We get the drought that is popping up all over the world. We get the 3,000-foot-tall dust storm in Phoenix, Arizona. We have all of these indications of an unstable climate system manifesting at the same time, thousands of them over the course of the last year. Unusual events are in the headlines every day now with respect to weather. Connecting the dots on those, I don't see us able to grow the food we've been able to grow at scale simply because the weather becomes too unstable to do so. Civilizations arose to begin with 6 or 7 times around the globe, pretty much simultaneously, because Earth came out of an ice age, warmed slightly, about a degree and a half above the ice age, and then the temperature stabilized globally. And once it had stabilized for a few thousand years, civilizations popped up pretty much simultaneously all over the globe. Was because the slightly warmer than ice age conditions and stable climatic conditions. We now have produced a situation in which we no longer have stable climatic conditions around the globe, and nowhere is this more evident than in the interior of large continents, especially in the northern hemisphere. So places like Siberia, where the permafrost has become permamelt, yesterday's headline from Siberia indicates a massive landslide as a result of permafrost melting. We have the Dust Bowl that is here already and is being exacerbated every year. We have those tremendous floods. The list goes on. The weather is unstable because the climate is unstable, and therefore the ability to grow grains is threatened. Grains form the basis for every civilization so far, including this one. It's not just about the digits on the computer screen. It's about the ability to grow and store food. As Daniel Quinn described in his book Ishmael and many other books, civilization is best described with 5 words. They lock up the food. We can only do that with food that can be stored. Food that can be stored best at scale is grains, things like wheat, corn, oats, and so on. And when the ability to grow and store that food is threatened, we're talking about the collapse of civilization in a relatively short period of time, and then very quickly thereafter, the instability of the climate system that has supported our own existence on this planet disappearing in a very short period of time. This is horrible news. I'm not happy to present it. I'm not a proponent of the decline of our species. I'm just reporting the news and connecting the dots where it goes from my perspective as a conservation biologist.
Yeehaw! I sometimes wonder how Guy might feel about some of his old university teaching days. Suck it, academia. You treated me just fucking great. Now I'm leading world's greatest debate. Future generations' great dissertations will feature my work. Oh, wait.
Yeah, Benji, what future generations? Number 3. In the words of Gary Null from his show 4 weeks ago, quote, "Much of academia is either too dishonest, in the pay of special interests, or they are in that rotating system of going from the government back into industry back into government," end quote. Again, I refer the listener to the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins for more on that revolving door. Perkins distinguishes between the financial sector, who don't do any first-hand environmental destruction, and the energy and manufacturing sectors, who do, but it comes to the same, as my comrades across the pond like to say. Your comments, Guy?
I'd like to point out that Peter Wadhams, formerly director of the ocean physics program at Cambridge University and forced into retirement because he was presenting evidence regarding the Arctic ice. According to his calculations from 2012, the loss of albedo alone from the Arctic ice, never mind the methane release, just loss of albedo alone, or loss of reflectance as that ice goes away, Well, it's already increased the global heat absorption, the global energy absorption of the planet from 0.43 watts per square meter up to about 0.75 watts per square meter from the 1990s. And he predicts it'll be more than 2 watts per square meter. That's at the global level. And so he was forced into retirement from Cambridge University and now works at a smaller college in Ireland. He also indicated to me via email correspondence that I'm being too conservative, that my connecting the dots with respect to these self-reinforcing feedback loops or so-called positive feedbacks that are not really positive, that my approach was too conservative. I was simply adding together the 1.6 degrees Celsius that he comes up with from lack of albedo and adding that together with about 1.1 degrees C from methane release, a very conservative number. He says, it's far worse than that. Taking the conservative approach, you should be multiplying those together, not simply adding them together. So here's another case of even the very conservative approach taken by me and other climate scientists leading to disparagement, and in his case, loss of a very privileged position at Cambridge University because he was connecting a few dots. It's truly horrible. No mainstream scientist can actually connect the dots and remain supported in his or her job. Now, I'm not saying they're all going to lose their jobs. I'm just indicating that they're going to lose support for their jobs. And that's why Jason Box left Ohio State University because he was censored. That's why Camille Parmesan left the University of Texas to go to London because she was censored. That's why I left the University of Arizona more than 7 years ago because I was heavily censored. Peter Wadhams is an exceptional case in that he was actually forced into retirement. He wasn't being censored and then took the active choice of leaving. He was actually forced out. So when we put together this information about these self-reinforcing feedback loops, it paints a truly dire picture for our species, never mind the continuation of this set of living arrangements, but for our species and for so many other species that are being driven to extinction by the actions of, quote, civilized society. Already, for example, we know based on a United Nations report from August 2010 that we are driving to extinction some 150 to 200 species every day. That's the estimate. That's a lot of species going over the edge. And it shouldn't surprise us too terribly that if our actions cause that to happen every single day and we don't take action to reverse direction, then indeed we will end up in the direction we're headed.
Goodreads attributes that quote to author Jody Picoult, although I always thought it was one of those pieces of wisdom from Confucius or perhaps Yogi Berra. In its original form, it says, if we don't change the direction we are headed, we will end up where we are going. But who can change the direction of a runaway freight train? Before I pose one last discussion question, here's another of your biggest fans with an offering for your birthday.
Hi, it's Deborah Kale Earnshaw here. My poem today is by Czesław Miłosz. He's a Polish poet who saw the worst of the upheavals of the 20th century. He survived the occupation of Poland and was later a cultural attaché of the new Polish Republic. In 1951, he defected to the West and soon published an influential work called The Captive Mind. The book studied some of the self-delusions that some of his intellectual contemporaries fell prey to on their way from autonomy to obedience in the communist times. It's a study of the appeal of authoritarianism to the intelligentsia. Perhaps this has some relevance for many of the environmental scientists today. The poem is called A Song on the End of the World. On the day the world ends, a bee circles a clover. A fisherman mends a glimmering net. Happy porpoises jump in the sea. By the rain spout, young sparrows are playing, and the snake is gold-skinned, as it should always be. On the day the world ends, women walk through the fields under umbrellas. A drunkard grows sleepy at the edge of a lawn. Vegetable peddlers shout in the street, and a yellow-sailed boat comes nearer the island. The voice of a violin lasts in the air and leads into a starry night. and those who expected lightning and thunder are disappointed, and those who expected signs and archangels' trumps do not believe it is happening now. As long as the sun and the moon are above, as long as the bumblebee visits a rose, as long as rosy infants are born, no one believes it is happening now. Only a white-haired old man, who would be a prophet, yet is not a prophet, for he's much too busy, repeats while he binds his tomatoes, "There will be no other end of the world. There will be no other end of the world." Warsaw, 1944.
Thank you, Deba. That was a moving piece of poetry, beautifully read. And that poet's name again, please, in case we want to check out the collection?
Czesław Miłosz.
Thanks. Polish mystifies me. That's Czelaw Miłosz. Or, for my friends across the pond, Czelaw Miłosz. Okay, back to you, Guy. As your grand finale, would you project for us a timeline and a marching order for when you believe the different components of the diverse civilizations around the world will begin to end?
I think it's already underway. The headlines you read tell us the story for anybody who's willing to listen. I think that we are seeing Dust Bowl-like conditions manifest already. I think we're seeing a lack of potable water for millions, perhaps billions of people around the globe. I think we're seeing food insecurity already presenting itself in the less wealthy countries around the planet. This is already underway. It's going to get worse. There's approximately a 10-year lag between emission of carbon dioxide and maximum heating associated with the carbon dioxide molecules. It's going to get worse. There is no way to avoid it. We are experiencing global average temperature now that results from actions in the past. The future is already locked in at some level, and we can take individual actions to try to make the situation better. But at some level, we have already triggered all those self-reinforcing feedback loops we've been talking about. Permafrost, loss of albedo, methane release from the Arctic Ocean, on and on the list goes. There's no stopping them now. The genie's out of the bottle. I think we have as little as 18 months before we're in a cataclysmic environment based on loss of Arctic ice, or essentially loss of Arctic ice, less than 1 million square kilometers, and the subsequent release of methane. That could happen very easily this summer and lead to major crop failure throughout the globe next spring and summer. So I'm not talking about a situation that's going to manifest 10 years down the road. We could easily be facing a situation within 18 months where we are locked in a daily struggle for our lives, even here in the relatively privileged, quote, first world nations.
Unfortunately, the interview ended on that rather bleak note without asking Guy how we can respond in the face of such devastating knowledge. Instead, there seemed to be another instance of the assumption that Guy is recommending giving up, as if saving this sorry species is the only reason for taking right action. I'm glad that I've heard enough of Guy's recent interviews to realize that he is recommending no such thing. Had I been conducting that interview, and if I were of Gary Null's mind, namely that we are such a clever species that we're bound to come up with something in the end, because we always have in the past, I would like to think I would have had the presence of mind to ask a fifth question. If, in your opinion, our demise is already baked in, why bother getting out of bed in the morning? And then maybe Dr. McPherson could have responded along the lines that extinction is the rule, not the exception, in the evolution of species. It's just that ours is exerting more than its fair share of selective pressure on all of the others. So the sooner we get out of the way, the more of a chance there will be for other, not-so-complex life forms to survive. Nobody said it would be easy. Nobody said it would be pretty. Now is the time to find gratitude for having been born into whatever level of privilege we have, even if it's just running water that we don't have to carry from its source to our homes. Most of us have far more than we need when it comes to amenities, and that's my personal definition of greed, taking more than I need. I've come to believe that extinction is as necessary and natural to evolution as death is necessary and natural to life. Perhaps the next dominant sentient species will play its part in the cosmic dance more willingly, rather than trying to design the choreography. Why bother getting out of bed in the morning? The so-called doomer community, the folks who have a working familiarity with and acceptance of our predicament, seem to be of various minds on that question, depending on which of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of the grieving process they're in. Giving up is the mark of despair or deep sadness. We've all been there, but we don't stay there because, quite simply, giving up is boring. Doing nothing is boring. I don't know anyone who advocates doing nothing, although I think it's important to accept doing nothing if that's where a person is at, even if the person is myself. There are those who would employ desperate measures, whether escaping to a terraformed planet somewhere or geoengineering of some sort here on Earth. That's bargaining. It's like people who, when faced with a terminal diagnosis, engage in a frenzied search for ever newer specialists with ever more exotic snake oil to sell. The angry ones are those who are out there fighting for some flavor of justice, or accountability, or reparations. A day late and a dollar short, I'm afraid. These tend to be liberals or progressives of privilege, who are accustomed to using money as the solution to all problems. Then there are the deniers, yes, even among the doomers, those who are prepping their bunkers and refusing to accept any information until it shows up in the peer-reviewed literature or comes down through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the cop-out conferences. And there are those who spend more time in acceptance, in doing their shadow work, in dealing with their addictions, in making amends to each other and to the Earth herself. I count myself among these, and I believe Guy is there too, with his tagline, "At the edge of extinction, only love remains," which I have integrated into my reality. Even the Buddhist types stand ready to be of comfort and support to fellow sojourners, and that's a far cry from doing nothing. In addition to Guy, I offer a shout-out on that score to Zhiwa Woodbury of Planetary Hospice, Derek Jensen with his deep green resistance, Joanna Macy with her work that reconnects, Carolyn Baker of Return to Joy, Ivy Cohn with her Fuki Cafe, Charles Eisenstein with his Space Between Stories, Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, and I'm sure I'm forgetting loads of people who are having impacts that go unseen beyond their immediate sphere of influence. As it should be, after all. You don't have to be a rock star to relieve suffering. You only need the courage to look suffering in the eye and say, "I see you, and I'm here anyway." I'm a bit hypersensitive to the issue of denying suffering at the moment because of a couple of fake news stories that just crossed my desk, both of which were celebration of supposed indigenous victories, when I'm sitting in deep grief about the flip side of the story. One was dealing with the Amazon, which I mentioned earlier in the show, and the other declared a victory at Standing Rock, where the pipeline is expected to be sending oil under Lake Oahe in about 2 weeks' time, which would have been impossible had the so-called rule of law been in force. In fact, another item just crossed my desk that I want to flag for your urgent attention, and that is another march on Washington, D.C., and with solidarity actions from coast to coast and around the world, this one on behalf of treaty rights for indigenous people. It is called for 10 March, 2 days after the Day Without a Woman. In fact, 8 and 9 March are set as citizen lobbying days, and I would hope there would also be lots of training going on related to civil disobedience and nonviolent resistance of all sorts. It's time to stop demanding such things and start doing them ourselves to the best of our ability in the spirit of ready or not, here we come. The world can't wait. The earth can't wait. So happy birthday, Guy McPherson, and thanks very much for the way you keep showing up with no compensation and in the face of disparagement and even harassment. Thanks to Gary Null for an enormous head start on the climate change update. Thanks to Benjamin the Donkey and Deba Cale Earnshaw for their poetic embellishments to the show, to the Beatles for the birthday song, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.